Dave Brubeck is a phenomenon. Dave Brubeck was a public sensation. Dave Brubeck was an extremely successful commercial artist. But at the end of the day, to understand his achievement, you must listen to the music.
As a composer of tunes, Brubeck is rather amazing. There are, he tells me, hundreds of compositions that have not been performed. He writes them like some people write postcards.
You can't fake the kind of talent that he has over the period of years that he has. I mean, he is an excellent musician who has said something meaningful to a large number of people over a lot of years.
He is one of the most famous jazz musicians in history. He sells out stadiums and concert halls throughout the world. He was the first jazz musician to sell 1 million copies of one of his albums, and one of the first to appear on the cover of Time magazine. And he created a huge new audience for jazz through his trailblazing concert appearances on college campuses. I'm Nancy Wilson. On this edition of NPR's Jazz Profiles, NEA Jazz Master Dave Brubeck. Jazz critic Doug Ramsey.
I like Brubeck's piano playing because I have been able to accept it on its own terms. If you approach Brubeck's piano playing with the idea that he's Bill Evans or Oscar Peterson or Art Tatum or you name it, then you won't enjoy it because you'll be expecting him to be something he's not.
Pianist Billy Taylor.
He plays the piano like a composer. I mean, he's composing when he plays. And that was one of the things that I always liked about him. He really tried very hard to get the compositional elements going when he played the instrument. And so much of what he did was orchestral from that point of view. But it was just fun to hear him paint himself into a corner and try to get out. I mean, not a lot of guys will do that in public. You know?
Dave Brubeck.
You're always looking for that great marriage of creativity that you can pull off technically. But if I can't pull it off technically, I'll go for the creativity and maybe be sloppy, where some guys won't allow themselves to be sloppy. And I think they lose creativity. The jazz musician should create on the spot and take chances. Otherwise, why don't you go hear a classical pianist?
As a band leader, composer, and pianist, Dave Brubeck has followed his own unique muse to astonishing success. He works a punishing schedule while never compromising his musical vision and staying true to his internal moral and creative compass. Dave Brubeck was born in 1920. And raised on a huge cattle ranch in a desolate part of Northern California. His father was the ranch's manager and a national rodeo champion. His mother was a fine pianist who had aspired to the concert stage. Dave says he can't remember a time when the Brubeck home wasn't filled with the sounds of music.
My mother believed even in prenatal influence, so that she practiced most of the day or taught music, so. Before you were born, all you were hearing was the piano. And right after you were born, she had to keep teaching. And so you were put in the crib right next to the piano.
Though music was everywhere growing up, Dave had eye problems that kept him from learning to read music, something he has difficulty with to this day. But he had a great ear and loved to improvise at the piano, something his mother encouraged. She was strict, though, about what music he was able to hear in her home. Young Brubeck would have to go to a neighbor's house to listen to the radio or hear jazz records. It wasn't until he was a teenager that he was able to purchase any of his own.
The first recording I ever bought was Fats Waller's Let's Be Fair and Square in Love. And on the other side of this old 78 was There's Honey, Honey on the Moon Tonight. So that was a big event in my life. I remember going in from the cattle ranch to Sacramento to the Sherman and Clay store and buying this record and thinking, boy, what a great thing I've done today.
There's honey on the moon tonight. It's a sin if we waste it. Come along and let's taste it. Had it ordered for you. Yes, you, baby. There's honey on the moon tonight, though a little off season. It is there for a reason, for a dream to come true. My, my.
At age 15, Dave Brubeck began playing piano at Saturday night dances in the small mining towns of Northern California. He continued to play music on the weekends throughout his high school years and into college, where he majored in music. After graduation, he enlisted in the Army and was sent to a base in Southern California to join one of the Army's bands. While stationed there, he had some memorable musical experiences. He looked up the esteemed composer, Arnold Schoenberg, then a professor at UCLA, and asked him for private composition lessons. But the relationship was short-lived. They got into an argument over one of Brubeck's compositions and parted in anger. Dave fared a bit better when he approached another of his musical idols, bandleader Stan Kenton, and offered him one of his compositions. Kenton played it once and pronounced it too far ahead of its time. This was neither the first nor the last time Brubeck's music would be met with skepticism. He experienced it again while auditioning for another Army band.
And in that band was Paul Desmond, the alto saxophonist that later was in the octet. And of course, everyone knows him from the quartet. And I was very wild harmonically in those days, and often played in two keys at the same time. And the first chord I hit scared Desmond to the point where he thought I was stark raving mad.
After World War II, Dave left the Army and joined a graduate program in music at Mills College. The program was led by the famed French composer Darius Milhaud. For Dave, studying with Milhaud, who pioneered the fusion of jazz and classical music, was a life-changing experience.
Milhaud, one day in class, said, how many jazz musicians are there in the class? And we raised our hands, and he said, I'd like for you to write your counterpoint and fugue and even compositions for the jazz people. Now, this amazed us because we were used to being told if you're jazz musicians, you know, don't even play it near the conservatory. And here's one of the top composers of the world saying to write for the jazz people in class. So the octet was born right in Milhaud's classroom.
Dave Brubeck's arrangement of The Way You Look Tonight from 1948. It was performed by an octet made up of several of his classmates and friends, including a young Paul Desmond on alto sax. During its existence in the late 40s and early 50s, the Brubeck Octet would alternate between fairly radical arrangements of jazz standards and original compositions of a more classical nature. Ted Gioia is author of West Coast Jazz.
If you look at a Brubeck piece called Playland at the Beach, which is a brilliant 90-second gem that he wrote in 1948, there are little bits of jazz elements there, but you hear just as much of other things. There are bits of Renaissance fanfares. There's a lot of dissonance that would be comparable to what he was studying with Mio. In many ways, the achievement of the octet was that, as I see it, it was one-third a jazz group and two-thirds a contemporary classical ensemble. That was very different. And actually, to this day, I don't think there are many groups that picked up on the achievement of the octet.
Desmond and the Dave Brubeck Octet performing a Brubeck composition, Playland at the Beach. Although their musical marriage was harmonious at first, a bitter falling out between Desmond and Brubeck would keep them apart for several years in the late 1940s. During that time, Brubeck formed a trio and began performing on a popular San Francisco radio program. The broadcast proved so successful that in 1949, the trio started to release records. The group became a sensation within the jazz world, earning rave reviews from some important jazz critics of the day. They also won both the Metronome and Downbeat polls for the best new combo in 1950. One of the things critics noticed about Brubeck was the way he combined jazz with elements of classical music, such as polytonality. Again, jazz historian Ted Gioia.
What I especially admire about the trio music is how Brubeck was able to squeeze his eccentricities and modernistic tendencies into very simple, almost even banal pop songs. Take Blue Moon, for instance. Brubeck takes this piece and he forces it to bear the weight of all his experimentalism. You hear the quirky chords and rhythms, the reharmonizations, little hints of polytonality, in which you'd have a certain chord structure which would be the standard chord progression of the piece. And what Brubeck would do would be to superimpose other chords on top of it. What that would create in terms of sounds was a little bit of a clash, a little bit of a dissonance. But depending on how cleverly and slyly you use the polytonality, you can make it sound like it fits in.
The Dave Brubeck Trio and their rendition of Blue Moon. Coming up on Jazz Profiles, more about the life and music of NEA jazz master Dave Brubeck. I'm Nancy Wilson. As the Brubeck Trio's star began to rise, Paul Desmond heard them on the radio while he was playing with another group on the East Coast. He returned to the Bay Area, determined to get back into Brubeck's good graces and back into his band, Dave Brubeck.
Eventually, Paul showed up at my front door in San Francisco, and I had told my wife, don't let Paul Desmond in his house. He's let me down too many times. And my wife always liked Paul. And she let him in, and I was out in the backyard hanging up diapers. I remember it so well. And Paul came in, and he had already charmed my wife into getting back in the group. And he also charmed me, and I forgave him all the things he had done.
Even though Dave had forgiven Paul and was once again enthusiastic about playing with him, club owners were less than happy to see Desmond sitting in with Dave's group. Audiences wanted to hear the Brubeck Trio as they had heard and loved them on record, not to hear Paul Desmond. It would take a terrible twist of fate while the trio was playing in Hawaii to finally bring the quartet together.
In 1951, I was swimming on Waikiki Beach, and I was just playing around with my kids and said, "Watch Daddy," my famous last words. And I ran and dove into a wave that was coming in, but I saw in a flash that this wave was not strong, and there was a sandbar right ahead of me. And I should have hit it with my face. Instead, I turned my head to avoid hitting it with my face, and that almost broke my neck.
Jazz historian Ted Gioia.
Dave's swimming accident, which for many years was not publicized in the jazz world, actually, if you look back on it, that was in many ways a turning point in his career. First of all, he brought Paul Desmond into the band, and the trio grew into a quartet. I think Dave felt that with the injury he had sustained, that he needed another soloist there to take up some of the burden. The result was breathtaking. You listen to some of those early quartet recordings, and you really feel the spontaneity of the moment. You really feel that the whole band, especially Brubeck and Desmond, are playing off what's happening then and there.
One of the many ways that Brubeck was innovative was in releasing live records, something relatively unheard of prior to the success of his albums on Fantasy, a label, by the way, that he was one of the founders of. The first live record he released came from a remarkable performance at Boston's Storyville nightclub. One cut off that album was a unique rendition of Harold Arlen's Over the Rainbow. Jazz historian Ted Gioia.
Now, you have to realize at the time Brubeck recorded this, the big thing in jazz piano was an approach which emphasized playing very fast improvised lines in the right hand. Now, by putting so much emphasis on two-handed chordal playing, Brubeck, I think, was making a statement, but even more than that, he was showing an alternative way to approach modern jazz improvisation. I think it's also worth pointing out that a lot of Brubeck's work on this piece is played right on the beat, with only a few uses of syncopation, although very effective uses. Now, this is very unusual in jazz, and it's a testament to Brubeck. If you talk to most jazz players, they would tell you that you could not play jazz effectively while playing on the beat and not using a lot of syncopation. Yet Brubeck does it here, and it's absolutely brilliant.
Thank you. Dave Brubeck and Paul Desmond playing Over the Rainbow at Boston's Storyville nightclub in 1952. In addition to being one of the first jazz musicians to release live records, Brubeck was also innovative in other ways. His wife, Iola, had come up with the idea of marketing the Brubeck Quartet for concerts on college campuses.
After all, students at that time really didn't have very much money. A lot of them didn't have cars in order to go great distances to hear someone. And I think that by bringing the music to them on the campus in a situation where they could afford the tickets and not have to pay nightclub prices and that sort of thing, really was a foot in the door.
Record producer George Avakian.
They sent out, I don't know, maybe 100, 150 letters, and they've got a half a dozen, 10 concerts the first year, and the second year he got more. And when he attracted the attention of Joe Glazer's booking office, Joe, of course, was the manager of Louis Armstrong, and he had a company called Associated Booking Corporation, which specialized in jazz and blues artists. They signed Dave up and took advantage of his entree in the colleges to start booking their other artists there. And that's how the college concert circuit really was created. It was created by Dave Brubeck and his wife sitting down with the World Almanac on their kitchen table and duplicating letters and mailing them out, licking the stamps themselves.
Perdido, from the popular 1953 album, Jazz at Oberlin. The year 1953 was a dizzying one for the quartet. They won all the major critics' polls and became one of the best-selling groups in jazz. When his contract came up for renewal, Brubeck left Fantasy Records for a more lucrative deal with Columbia. They quickly seized on the college theme and released Jazz Goes to College. In addition to being one of the most popular jazz records of the 1950s, that record also served as a showcase for another of Dave Brubeck's many talents, jazz critic Doug Ramsey.
Now, another aspect of his piano playing, which has been widely discussed, partly because Paul Desmond was a missionary for this, was that Brubeck is a great accompanist. And there are several remarkable instances in the quartet recordings of Brubeck supporting Desmond on some ungodly flights of fancy where he couldn't possibly hope to get out alive, but Brubeck sort of provided the harmonic net that made it possible for Desmond to do a lot of those fantastic solos. Le Souk on Jazz Goes to College, that's probably the best example I can think of. That piece was not a composed piece. It was something that just happened on the concert, and Desmond started off in this sort of semi-Asiatic oriental direction, and Brubeck followed him, and they pieced this thing together as they went along. It could never have been done if Brubeck hadn't been so finely attuned to his fellow player and willing to support him rather than trying to be the star of the piece.
The spectacular success of Jazz Goes to College and the group's continued sellout concerts all over the country led Time magazine to place Dave Brubeck on its cover in November of 1954. Only the second jazz musician to be given that honor. Although the Time cover story opened even more doors for the quartet in terms of bookings and television appearances, it was a decidedly mixed blessing. It seemed that almost overnight, they were shunned by many in the jazz world for having sold out. That Dave's music wasn't really jazz, that it didn't swing, charges that dogged the quartet for years to come. Baritone saxophonist Jerry Mulligan.
I mean, they used to have dumb arguments like that. Is this jazz? Is this? Who cares? Dave carved a place for himself in the midst of the whole thing and made a unique contribution because of it. And unique in every sense of the word, you know. There's only one Dave, and the stuff that he did is things that he did. Nobody else did.
In addition to problems with the critics, several musicians also took the Brubeck Quartet to task for their lack of swing. Miles Davis was one of them, Dave Brubeck.
And then one night, we were both playing at the Blackhawk in San Francisco, and Ella Fitzgerald came in after her job to hang out at the Blackhawk, as a lot of musicians did. And wanted to sing, and I was the only one in my group that was left there. So it was just Ella and I, and Miles was sitting at the bar. And after we finished doing two or three tunes, I went back over, and Miles said, "Your group don't swing, but you do."
Miles Davis performing a Dave Brubeck original, The Duke. Miles especially admired Brubeck's writing. It was Davis more than anyone who helped popularize Brubeck's music among other jazz musicians by recording his compositions. Given the eventual popularity of many of Brubeck's tunes with both the public and the jazz community, it is ironic that for many years during the height of his fame, Brubeck wrote no jazz compositions at all. After the commercial failure of his octet, which primarily performed original compositions, he assumed that all listeners wanted to hear were jazz standards.
And then one night, we were in Rochester, New York, after a concert. Paul Desmond said, "We've got to get somebody to write some original music for us." And I said to Paul, "You've got to be kidding. I'll write two tunes in a half hour." And one was called In Your Own Sweet Way, and the other was called The Waltz. And from then on, I started writing for the group whole albums of originals.
Original composition, In Your Own Sweet Way. Jazz critic, Doug Ramsey.
As a composer of tunes, Brubeck is rather amazing. There are, he tells me, hundreds of compositions that have not been performed. He writes them like some people write postcards. The ones that are best known, I think, and recorded most often by other musicians are In Your Own Sweet Way and The Duke. What has always puzzled me is that there are equally attractive Brubeck songs that don't get covered by other musicians. Strange Meadowlark, for instance.
Jazz historian Ted Gioia.
I think Dave's compositions are very central to his achievement as a jazz player. And even his improvisations sound compositional in the way they flow. Dave had a way of thinking about music which, to my mind, integrated the chord progressions, the melodies, the rhythms, and that the pieces seemed to flow on their own. He has put together a body of powerful work, I think, that's only now beginning to be fully appreciated and the depth of it realized by others in the jazz community.
Just ahead on Jazz Profiles, the big hit, Take Five, and more about NEA Jazz Master Dave Brubeck. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR, National Public Radio. As Brubeck became more consumed with writing music for his group, there occurred a personnel change that would dramatically affect the character of the quartet. Brubeck hired Joe Morello, who had been the drummer in Marin McPartland's trio. Morello was an incredibly gifted musician capable of playing almost anything on his instrument. With a drummer like Morello in the band, Brubeck was able to return to some of the more difficult rhythmic ideas that he'd attempted during the days of the octet. One of them was the use of polyrhythms. Drummer Joe Morello.
People ask all the time, what is a polyrhythm? Basically what it is, it's two rhythms going on at the same time. In other words, let's make it simple. Say that I'm playing a pulse of four beats to a bar, and you can play maybe five on top of that, or you could play three in the space of four. So you got two rhythms going at once. That's basically what polyrhythms are. Like we do a waltz thing with Dave. We do Someday My Prince will come, and I'd play in 3-4, and Gene would just be on the downbeat, 1-2-3, 1-2-3-1, and then Dave would play a basic two against that, so it's like a two against three. I'd be playing three, Dave would be playing in two. Thank you.
The Dave Brubeck Quartet and their version of Someday My Prince Will Come from the 1957 album Dave Digs Disney. In 1958, Brubeck made one more important change in his rhythm section by hiring veteran bass player Eugene Wright, known to his fellow musicians as the Senator. With Morello and Wright now in the group, Brubeck had the firm foundation he needed to pursue his experimental musical ideas. Eugene Wright.
Whenever we hit the stand, we were cooking. Joe Morello and I would be smoking back there so hard that Dave and Paul, they'd look around and say, well, these guys are serious. We're going to do what we're going to do. And after a year with Dave, Joe Morello and I had it so we could put Dave in a pocket. He couldn't get out. And of course, he'd take care of the business. He'd say, oh, that's weird. And Dave would go on and play. And he got a chance to play the things he had popping in his mind because, you see, he knew that Joe Morello, the time was impeccable. He knew that the Senator was going to keep that foundation there because I'm a rhythm bass player, you know. So he had a rhythm bass, he had the drum time, and he had Paul Desmond with the beautiful melodic sounds and all the things like that in counterpoint. Then he had all that room for himself to play the party rhythm. And so when I got in the group, Dave finally had the kind of bass player he needed. He had a bass player who would maintain the bottom.
Tangerine recorded live in Copenhagen, Denmark in 1958. In the jazz world of the late 1950s, even waltzes were considered exotic. So when Dave Brubeck decided to record a whole album built around unusual time signatures, it's not surprising that his record label was dead against it. Luckily, the president of Columbia, Goddard Lieberson, heard the album and loved it.
What they were against, they explained to me, is these are unwritten laws that you've broken. You have a painting on the cover. We've never done that. You have all originals. We've never done that. And you also have most of the album in odd time signatures that the public can't dance to. So here was all these unwritten laws that I had broken. And finally Goddard, the president, got the album out. And the acceptance of it showed that you could go in and do something avant-garde, experimental, and still have the public follow you.
The Time Out album was a phenomenon in the jazz world. It has sold well over 1 million copies since its original release in 1960, unheard of, at the time, for any instrumental group, let alone a jazz band. And the album spawned a hit single. It was built around a 5-4 rhythm that drummer Joe Morello was fond of. Paul Desmond took the beat and wrote a melody against it. The result was Take Five. Paul Desmond.
That was Dave's idea, to give him ultimate credit. And he said, why don't we do this album and do all different time signatures? And for some reason, I lucked out. I really did. He said, okay, why don't you take 5-4? And I wrote Take Five. At the time, I really thought it was kind of a throwaway. And thing that makes Take Five work is the bridge, which we almost didn't use. I shudder to think how close we came of not using that, because I said, I got this theme that we could use for a middle part. And Dave said, well, let's run it through. And that's what made Take Five.
Jazz historian Ted Gioia.
In the piece Take Five, the time signature is unusual and it's very difficult to play. But what Brubeck did to root it was to use that very simple vamp that underlies the whole improvisation. I think in many ways that was a powerful trademark of Dave. Complexity and simplicity wedded together so that you could appreciate the music on two levels, both for its musicological sophistication, but also because it sounded very good.
The success of Take Five and the Time Out album reignited the critical flames that had been directed at Brubeck since he appeared on the cover of Time magazine in 1954. It seemed now more than ever that the music world was split between those who loved the quartet and those who hated it. There was no middle ground. Yet an ever-increasing number of Brubeck fans were absolutely oblivious to what the critics were saying. They continued to buy the albums and jam the concert halls, forcing many critics to scratch their heads and wonder why.
Why we were popular is a very good question, because we cut right across the whole jazz community from being able to play at the Apollo and win the Black Music Poll of the Pittsburgh Courier to playing with the New York Philharmonic. It seemed like the public would follow us into most things that weren't being done a lot, like ballet or later on sacred music. How and why, I don't know, but I feel very fortunate.
Jazz critic Doug Ramsey.
Well, I have a very uncomplicated theory about the reasons for Brubeck's success in those early days. One was exposure on the college campuses. A huge number of young people whose musical tastes were just forming got to see and hear that band live, and it helped create the musical taste that they would carry with them the rest of their lives. And another thing was that if you ever saw that band live during that period or any time during the life of the original quartet, they were having as much fun as the audience was.
In the early 60s, in addition to his time signature experiments, Brubeck worked on several different non-jazz projects, including a ballet score and an orchestral piece entitled Elementals. But the work that was nearest and dearest to his heart during that time was also one of the most frustrating. A planned Broadway show starring Louis Armstrong with book and lyrics written by his wife, Iola. It was called The Real Ambassadors. The show's social themes were apparently too controversial for Broadway producers, and it was only performed once at the Monterey Jazz Festival.
I'm the real ambassador. It is evident I was sent by government to take your place. All I do is play the blues and meet the people face to face. I'll explain and make it plain. I represent the human race and don't pretend no more. Who's the real ambassador? Certain facts we can't ignore. In my humble way, I'm the USA. Though I represent the government don't represent some policies I'm for.
Although the quartet continued to sell millions of records and sell out theaters and concert halls wherever they toured, Brubeck was tired of life on the road. With spirituality becoming a progressively larger part of his life, he wanted to write music that addressed his passionate belief in brotherhood and world peace. In 1966, he gave the quartet a year's notice that he wanted to call it quits and devote himself to composing full-time.
When the year was up, I said, that's it. And I didn't think I could ever do that because the group was so wonderful, so successful. But I wanted to stay home with my children more, and I wanted to write sacred music. I have people in the choral field now that don't know that I'm a jazz musician. It's just the opposite of what it used to be. And to me, when I first heard that, I got a little excited. Well, at last I made it in the choral field. That guy doesn't say, oh, I only know you as a jazz musician. He only knows me as a choral composer.
An excerpt from Dave Brubeck's oratorio, The Light in the Wilderness. That was a 1968 recording with Eric Kunzel conducting the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra in chorus. This piece is just one of 10 major choral works that Brubeck has composed in recent years. In the early 70s, Brubeck began playing and recording with three of his sons as two generations of Brubeck. They would often go out on the road with some combination of Jerry Mulligan and Paul Desmond. In 1976, Brubeck and Desmond were reunited with Joe Morello and Gene Wright for a 25th anniversary tour of the Dave Brubeck Quartet. Even though it had been 8 years since the group had played together, the magic was clearly still there. After the 25th anniversary tour and Desmond's death from cancer a year later, Brubeck turned another corner in his career and formed a new quartet. Over the next 20 years, several different musicians would pass through this band until it solidified in the mid-80s. Brubeck is still working hard as ever. His concert schedule is remarkably busy, and he is still putting out new recordings. In recent years, he has been awarded a National Medal of the Arts, an NEA Jazz Master Award, and honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Grammys. And yet, with all this activity, what Brubeck says he really wants is to spend his time at home, composing. However, you should know that he's been telling interviewers that for a long time.
You see the binders all around? Those are all things I'm working on, trying to get finished by when they're supposed to be finished. The reason I just don't stay home and finish these projects is the desire to play jazz, which is one of the most strong forces in my life. And if I just sit home and compose, I feel like I've got to get out and play some jazz. And if I just play jazz, I feel like I got to sit home and compose. There's a lot of other things that I would like to do. Like to see my sons be recognized for their potential. To me, the family is the primary concern. There's a time when you take care of your kids and help them through life as good as you can. And then at the end, they're probably going to be there helping you through the end. And these are the great traditions of humanity, is the help that you get at various points in your life, when you're helpless as a baby, when you're helpless at the end. I hope I'm not helpless at the end. I hope I go out playing some stride piano.
The program on the life and music of Dave Brubeck was written, produced, and mixed by Dan Gettleman, with engineering help from Kirill Wheeler. Special thanks to Russell Gloyd, Matt Herman, Gene Lees, Lee Majors, George Moore, and Herb Wong, along with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University, and the Smithsonian Institution Jazz Oral History Program. Jazz Profiles was created by Tim Owens. Our producer is Saraya Muhammad. We had engineering help from Flan Williams and Patrick Murray at NPR West. Our technical director is Neil Tevold. NPR's director of music is Benjamin Rowe. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is Jazz Profiles from NPR, National Public Radio.